CD 3.
Chocolat by Joanne Harris. Lucy, do you see that man in the square? The one in the red shirt? Who is he? The child pulls a face. White chocolate mice are her special weakness. 5 for 10 francs. I slip a couple of extra ones into the paper cornet. You know him, don't you? She nods. Monsieur Muska, from the café. I know it. A drab little place down at the end of the Avenue des Francs-Bourgeois. 6 metal tables on the pavement, a faded orangino parasol. An ancient sign identifies it. Café de la République. Clutching her cornet of sweets, the small girl turns to go, reconsiders, turns again. You won't ever guess his favourite, she says. He hasn't got one. I find that difficult to believe. I smile. Everyone has a favourite, even Monsieur Muska. Lucy considers this for a moment. Maybe his favourite is the one he takes from someone else, she tells me limpidly. Then she is gone, with a little wave through the display window. Tell Anouk we're off to Les Marauds after school. I will. Les Marauds. I wonder what they find there to amuse them. The river with its brown, stinking banks, the narrow streets drifted with litter, an oasis for children, dens, flat stones flick-flacking across the stagnant water, secrets whispered, stick swords and shields made of rhubarb leaves, warfare amongst the blackberry tangle, tunnels, explorers, stray dogs, rumours, purloined treasures. Anouk came from school yesterday with a new jauntiness in her step and a picture she had drawn to show me. That's me, a figure in red overalls topped with a scribble of black hair. Pantoufle, the rabbit is sitting on her shoulder like a parrot, ears cocked. And Jeannot, a boy figure in green, one hand outstretched. Both children are smiling. It seems mothers, even schoolteacher mothers, are not allowed in Les Marauds. The plasticine figure still sits beside Anouk's bed, and she has stuck the picture to the wall above it. Pantoufle told me what to do. She scoops him up in a casual embrace. In this light I can see him quite clearly, like a whiskered child. I sometimes tell myself I should discourage this pretense of hers, but cannot bear to inflict such loneliness upon her. Maybe, if we can stay here, Pantoufle can give way to more substantial playmates. I'm glad you managed to stay friends, I told her, kissing the top of her curly head. Ask Jeannot if he wants to come here some day soon to help take down the display. You can bring your other friends, too. The gingerbread house? Her eyes were sunlight on water. Oh, yes! Skipping across the room with sudden exuberance, almost knocking over a stool, skirting an imaginary obstacle with a giant leap, then up the stairs 3 at a time. Race you, Pantoufle! A thump as she slammed the door against the wall. Bam! Bam! A sudden stabbing sweetness of love for her, taking me off guard as it always does. My little stranger, never still, never silent. I poured myself another cup of chocolate, turning as I heard the door chimes jangle. For a second I saw his face unguarded, the appraising look, chin thrust out, shoulders squared, the veins popping out on the bare, shiny forearms. Then he smiled, a thin smile, without warmth. Monsieur Muska, isn't it? I wondered what he wanted. He looked out of place, glancing, head lowered, at the displays. His gaze fell short of my face, flicking casually to my breasts, once, twice. What did she want? His voice was soft but heavily accented. He shook his head once as if in disbelief. What the hell did she want in a place like this? He indicated a tray of sugared almonds at 50 francs a packet. This sort of thing, eh? He appealed to me, hands spread. Weddings and christenings. What's she want with wedding and christening stuff? He smiled again. wheedling now, trying for charm and failing. What did she buy?
I take it you mean Josephine.
My wife.
He gave the words an odd intonation, a kind of flat finality.
That's women for you. Work yourself senseless to earn money to live on, and what do they do, huh? Waste it all on...
Another gesture at the ranks of chocolate gems, marzipan garlands, silver paper, silk flowers.
What was it, a present?
There was suspicion in his voice.
Who's she buying presents for? Herself.
He gave a short laugh, as if the thought was ludicrous. I didn't see what business it was of his. But there was a kind of aggression in his manner, a nervousness around the eyes and the gesticulating hands that made me careful. Not for myself. I learned enough ways to take care of myself in the long years with Mother. But for her. Before I could prevent it, an image leapt out from him towards me, a bloodied knuckle etched in smoke. I closed my fists under the counter. There was nothing in this man I wanted to see.
I think you may have misunderstood, I told him. I asked Josephine in for a cup of chocolate, as a friend.
Oh. He seemed taken aback for a moment. Then he gave that barking laugh again. It was almost genuine now, real amusement touched with contempt.
You want to be friends with Josephine?
Again the look of appraisal. I felt him comparing us, his hot eyes flicking to my breasts over the counter. When he spoke again, it was with a caress in the voice, a crooning note of what he imagined to be seduction.
You're new here, aren't you?
I nodded.
Perhaps we could get together sometime. You know, get to know each other.
Perhaps. I was at my most casual. Maybe you could ask your wife to come too, I added smoothly. A beat of time. He looked at me again, this time a measuring glance of sly suspicion.
She's not been saying anything, has she?
Blankly. What kind of thing?
A quick shake of the head. Nothing, nothing. She talks, that's all. She's all talk. Doesn't do anything but, eh? Day in, day out.
Again the short, mirthless laugh.
You'll find that out soon enough, he added with sour satisfaction.
I murmured something non-committal. Then, on impulse, I brought out a small packet of chocolate almonds from beneath the counter and handed them to him.
Perhaps you could give these to Josephine for me, I said lightly. I was going to give them to her, but I forgot.
He looked at me but did not move.
Give them to her, he repeated.
Free, on the house. I gave my most winning smile. A present. His smile broadened. He took the chocolates in their pretty silver sachet.
I'll see she gets them, he said, cramming the packet into his jeans pocket.
They're her favourites, I told him.
You won't go far in this job if you keep giving out freebies, he said indulgently. You'll be out of business in a month.
Again the hard, greedy look, as if I too were a chocolate he couldn't wait to unwrap.
We'll see, I said blandly, and watched him leave the shop and begin the road home, shoulders slouched in a thick-set James Dean swagger.
He didn't even wait to be out of sight before I saw him take out Josephine's chocolates and open the packet. Perhaps he guessed I might be watching. One, two, three. His hand went to his mouth with lazy regularity, and before he had crossed the square, the silver wrapping was already balled in a square fist, the chocolates gone. I imagined him cramming them in like a greedy dog who wants to finish his own food before robbing another's plate. Passing the baker's, he popped the silver ball at the bin outside, but missed, bouncing it off the rim and onto the stones. Then he continued on his way past the church and down the Avenue des Francs-Bourgeois, without looking back, his engineer boots kicking sparks from the smooth cobbles underfoot. Friday, February the 21st. The weather turned cold again last night. Saint Jerome's weather vane turned and swung in anxious indecision all night, scraping shrilly against its rusted moorings as if to warn against intruders. The morning began in fog so dense that even the church tower, 20 paces from the shop front, seemed remote and spectral. The bell for mass, tolling thickly through wadded candyfloss as the few comers approached, collars turned up against the fog to collect absolution. When she had finished her morning milk, I wrapped Anouk into her red coat and, in spite of her protests, pushed a fluffy cap onto her head. "Don't you want any breakfast?" She shook her head emphatically, grabbed an apple from a dish by the counter. "What about my kiss?" This has become a morning ritual. Wrapping sly arms around my neck, she licks my face wetly, jumps away giggling, blows a kiss from the doorway, runs out into the square. I mime appalled horror, wiping my face. She laughs delightedly, pokes out a small sharp tongue in my direction, bugles, "I love you," and is off like a scarlet streamer into the fog, her satchel dragging behind her. I know that in 30 seconds the fluffy hat will be relegated to the inside of the satchel, along with books, papers, and other unwanted reminders of the adult world. For a second I see Pantoufle again, jumping in her wake, and banish the unwanted image in haste. A sudden loneliness of loss. How can I face an entire day without her? And with difficulty I suppress an urge to call her back. 6 customers this morning. One is Guillaume, on his way back from the butcher's with a piece of boudin wrapped in paper. "Charlie likes boudin," he tells me earnestly. "He hasn't been eating very well recently, but I'm sure he'll love this." "Don't forget you have to eat, too," I remind him gently. "Of course." He gives his sweet, apologetic smile. "I eat like a horse. Really, I do." He gives me a sudden, stricken look. "Of course, it's Lent," he says. "You don't think animals should observe the Lenten fast, do you?" I shake my head at his dismayed expression. His face is small, delicately featured. He is the kind of man who breaks biscuits in two and saves the other half for later. "I think you should both look after yourselves better." Guillaume scratches Charlie's ear. The dog seems listless, barely interested in the contents of the butcher's package in the basket beside him. "We manage." His smile comes as automatically as the lie. "Really, we do." He finishes his cup of chocolat espresso. "That was excellent," he says, as he always does. "My compliments, Madame Rocher." I have long since stopped asking him to call me Vianne. His sense of propriety forbids it. He leaves the money on the counter, tips his old felt hat, and opens the door. Charlie scrambles to his feet and follows, lurching slightly to one side. Almost as soon as the door closes behind him, I see Guillaume stoop to pick him up and carry him. At lunchtime, I had another visitor. I recognized her at once, in spite of the shapeless man's overcoat she affects, the clever winter apple face beneath the black straw hat, the long black skirts over heavy work boots. "Madame Voisin, you said you'd drop in, didn't you? Let me get you a drink." Bright eyes flicked appreciatively from one side of the shop to another. I sensed her taking everything in. Her gaze came to rest on Anouk's menu. Chocolat chaud, 10 francs. Chocolat espresso, 15 francs. Chocochino, 12 francs. Mocha, 12 francs. She nodded approvingly. "It's been years since I had anything like this," she said. "I'd almost forgotten this sort of place existed." There is an energy in her voice, a forcefulness to her movements, which belies her age. Her mouth has a humorous twist, which reminds me of my mother. "I used to love chocolate," she declared. As I poured her a tall glass of mocha and added a splash of Kahlua to the froth, she surveyed the bar stools with some suspicion. "You don't expect me to climb all the way up there, do you?" I laughed. "If I'd known you were coming, I would have brought a ladder. Wait a moment." Stepping into the kitchen, I brought out Poitou's old orange chair. "Try this." Armand plumped into the chair and took her glass in both hands. She looked eager as a child, her eyes shining, her expression rapt. "Mmm. It was more than appreciation. It was almost reverence. She had closed her eyes as she tasted the drink. Her pleasure was almost frightening. This is the real thing, isn't it? She paused for a moment, bright eyes speculatively half-closed. There's cream and, cinnamon, I think? What else? Tia Maria? Close enough, I said. What's forbidden always tastes better anyway, declared Armand, wiping froth from her mouth in satisfaction. But this, she sipped again greedily, is better than anything I remember even from childhood. I bet there are 10,000 calories in here. More. Why should it be forbidden? I was curious. Small and round as a partridge, she seems as unlike her figure-conscious daughter as can be. Oh, doctors. Armand was dismissive. You know what they're like. They'll say anything. She paused to drink again through her straw. Oh, this is good. Good. Caro's been trying to make me go into some kind of a home for years. Doesn't like the idea of me living next door. Doesn't like to be reminded where she comes from. She gave a rich chuckle. Says I'm sick. Can't look after myself. Sends that miserable doctor of hers to tell me what I can eat and what I can't. Anyone would think they wanted me to live forever. I smiled. I'm sure Caroline cares very much about you, I said. Armand shot me a look of derision. Oh, you are. She gave a vulgar cackle of laughter. Don't give me that, girl. You know perfectly well that my daughter doesn't care for anyone but herself. I'm not a fool. A pause, as she narrowed her bright, challenging gaze at me. It's the boy I feel for, she said. Boy? Luke, his name is. My grandson. He'll be 14 in April. You may have seen him in the square. I remembered him vaguely. A colourless boy, too correct in his pressed flannel trousers and tweed jacket, cool green-grey eyes beneath a lank fringe. I nodded. I've made him the beneficiary of my will, Armand told me. 500,000 francs, in trust until his 18th birthday. She shrugged. I never see him, she added shortly. Caro won't allow it. I've seen them together. I remember now, the boy supporting his mother's arm as they passed on their way to church. Alone of all Lansquenet's children, he has never bought chocolates from La Praline, though I think I may have seen him looking in at the window once or twice. The last time he came to see me was when he was 10. Armand's voice was unusually flat. 100 years ago, as far as he's concerned. She finished her chocolate and put the glass back onto the counter with a sharp, final sound. It was his birthday, as I recall. I gave him a book of Rimbaud's poetry. He was very polite. There was bitterness in her tone. Of course, I've seen him in the street a few times since, she said. I can't complain. Why don't you call? I asked curiously. Take him out, talk. Get to know him. Armand shook her head. We fell out, Caro and I. Her voice was suddenly querulous. The illusion of youth had left with her smile, and she looked suddenly, shockingly old. She's ashamed of me. God knows what she's been telling the boy. She shook her head. No, it's too late. I can tell by the look on his face, that polite look, the polite, meaningless little messages in his Christmas cards. Such a well-mannered boy. Her laughter was bitter. Such a polite, well-mannered boy. She turned to me and gave me a bright, brave smile. If I could know what he was doing, she said, know what he reads, what teams he supports, who his friends are, how well he does at school, if I could know that. If? I could pretend to myself. For a second I saw her close to tears. Then a pause, an effort, a gathering of the will. Do you know, I think I might manage another of those chocolate specials of yours. How about another? It was bravado, but I admired it more than I could say.
that she can still play the rebel through her misery, the suspicion of a swagger in her movements as she props her elbows on the bar, slurping.
Sodom and Gomorrah through a straw. I think I just died and went to heaven. Close as I'm going to get, anyway.
I could get news of Luke, if you wanted. I could pass it on to you.
Armand considered this in silence. Beneath the lowered eyelids, I could feel her watching me, assessing. At last she spoke.
All boys like sweets, don't they?
Her voice was casual. I agreed that most boys did.
And his friends come here too, I suppose.
I told her I wasn't sure who his friends were, but that most of the children came and went regularly.
I might come here again, decided Armand. I like your chocolate, even if your chairs are terrible. I might even become a regular customer.
You'd be welcome, I said. Another pause. I understood that Armand Voisin does things in her own way, in her own time, refusing to be hurried or advised. I let her think it through.
Here, take this.
The decision was made. Briskly, she slapped a 100-franc note down on the counter.
But I...
If you see him, buy him a box of whatever he likes. Don't tell him they're from me.
I took the note.
And don't let his mother get to you. She's at it already, more than likely, spreading her gossip and her condescension. My only child, and she has to turn into one of Renault's Salvation Sisters.
Her eyes narrowed mischievously, working webby dimples into her round cheeks.
There are rumours already about you, she said. You know the kind. Getting involved with me will only make things worse.
I laughed. I think I can manage.
I think you can.
She looked at me, suddenly intent, the teasing note gone from her voice.
There's something about you, she said in a soft voice. Something familiar.
I don't suppose we've met before that time in Les Marais, have we?
Lisbon, Paris, Florence, Rome. So many people, so many lives intersected, fleetingly crisscrossed, brushed by the mad weft warp of our itinerary. But I didn't think so.
And there's a smell, something like burning, the smell of a summer lightning strike 10 seconds after. A scent of midsummer storms and cornfields in the rain.
Her face was rapt, her eyes searching out mine.
It's true, isn't it?
What I said?
What you are?
That word again. She laughed delightedly and took my hand. Her skin was cool, foliage, not flesh. She turned my hand over to see the palm.
I knew it.
Her finger traced lifeline, heartline.
I knew it the minute I saw you.
To herself, head bent, voice so low it was no more than a breath against my hand.
I knew it. I knew it.
But I never thought to see you here, in this town. A sharp, suspicious glance upwards.
Does Reno know?
I'm not sure. It was true, I had no idea what she was talking about. But I could smell it too, the scent of the changing winds, that air of revelation. A distant scent of fire and ozone, a squeal of gears left long unused, the infernal machine of synchronicity. Or maybe Josephine was right and Armand was crazy. After all, she could see Pantoufle.
Don't let Renaud know, she told me, her mad, earnest eyes gleaming.
You know who he is, don't you?
I stared at her. I must have imagined what she said then. Or maybe our dreams touched briefly once, on one of our nights on the run.
He's the black man.
Renaud. like a bad card, again and again. Laughter in the wings. Long after I had put Anouk to bed, I read my mother's cards for the first time since her death. I keep them in a sandalwood box, and they are mellow, perfumed with memories of her. For a moment I almost put them away unread, bewildered by the flood of associations that scent brings with it. New York, hot dog stands billowing steam, the Café de la Paix, with its immaculate waiters, a nun eating an ice cream outside Notre Dame Cathedral, one-night hotel rooms, surly doormen, suspicious gendarmes, curious tourists. And over it all, the shadow of it, the nameless, implacable thing we fled. I am not my mother. I am not a fugitive. And yet the need to see, to know, is so great that I find myself taking them from their box and spreading them, much as she did, by the side of the bed. A glance backwards to ensure Anouk is still asleep. I do not want her to sense my unease. Then I shuffle, cut, until I have four cards. 10 of Swords, death. 3 of Swords, death. 2 of Swords, death. The Chariot, death. The Hermit, the Tower, the Chariot. Death. The cards are my mother's. This has nothing to do with me, I tell myself, though the hermit is easy enough to identify. But the tower, the chariot, death. The death card, says my mother's voice within me, may not always portend the physical death of the self, but the death of a way of life, a change, a turning of the winds. Could this be what it means? I don't believe in divination, not in the way she did, as a way of mapping out the random patterns of our trajectory, not as an excuse for inaction, a crutch when things turn from bad to worse, a rationalization of the chaos within. I hear her voice now, and it sounds the same to me as it did on the ship, her strength transformed to sheer stubbornness, her humor into a fey despair. What about Disneyland? What do you think? The Florida Keys? The Everglades? There's so much to see in the New World, so much we haven't even begun to dream about. Is that it, do you think? Is that what the cards are saying? By then, death was on every card. Death and the black man, who had begun to mean the same thing. We fled him, and he followed, packed in sandalwood. As an antidote, I read Jung and Hermann Hesse, and learnt about the collective unconscious. Divination is a means of telling ourselves what we already know, what we fear. There are no demons, but a collection of archetypes every civilization has in common. The fear of loss, death. The fear of displacement, the tower. The fear of transience, the chariot. And yet Mother died. I put the cards away tenderly into their scented box. Goodbye, Mother. This is where our journey stops. This is where we stay to face whatever the wind brings us. I shall not read the cards again. Sunday, February the 23rd. Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. I know you can hear me, mon père. And there is no one else to whom I would care to confess, certainly not the bishop secure in his distant diocese of Bordeaux. And the church seems so empty. I feel foolish at the foot of the altar, looking up at our Lord in his guilt and agony. The gilding has tarnished with the smoke from the candles, and the dark staining gives him a sly and secretive look. And prayer, which came as such a blessing, such a source of joy in the early days, is a burden. A cry on the side of a bleak mountain which might at any time unleash the avalanche upon me. Is this doubt, mon père? This silence within myself, this inability to pray, to be cleansed, humbled, is it my fault? I look about the church, which is my life, and I try to feel love for it. Love as you loved for the statues. Saint Jerome with the chipped nose, the smiling Virgin, Jeanne d'Arc with her banner, Saint Francis with his painted pigeons. I myself dislike birds. I feel this may be a sin against my namesake, but I cannot help it. Their squawking, their filth, even at the doors of the church, the whitewashed walls streaked with the greenish daub of their leavings, their noise during sermons. I poison the rats which infest the sacristy and gnaw at the vestments there. Should I not also poison the pigeons which disrupt my service? I have tried, mon père, but to no avail. Perhaps Saint Francis protects them. If only I could be more worthy. My unworthiness dismays me. My intelligence, which is far in excess of that of my flock, serving only to heighten the weakness, the cheapness of the vessel God has chosen to serve. Is this my destiny? I dreamed of greater things, of sacrifices, of martyrdoms. Instead, I fritter away time in anxieties which are unworthy of me, unworthy of you. My sin is that of pettiness, mon père. For this reason, God is silent in his house. I know it, but I do not know how to cure the ill. I have increased the austerity of my Lenten fast, choosing to continue even on the days when a relaxation is permitted. Take today, for instance. I poured my Sunday libation onto the hydrangeas and felt a definite lifting of the spirit. For now, water and coffee will be the only accompaniment to my meals, the coffee to be taken black and sugarless to enhance the bitter taste. Today I had a carrot salad with olives, roots and berries in the wilderness. True, I feel a little light-headed now, but the sensation is not unpleasant. I feel a prick of guilt at the thought that even my deprivation gives me pleasure, and I resolve to place myself in the path of temptation. I shall stand for 5 minutes at the window of the rôtisserie, watching the chickens on the spit. If Arnaud taunts me, so much the better. In any case, he should be closed for Lent. As for Vianne Rocher, I have hardly thought of her these past few days. I walk past her shop with my face averted. She has prospered, in spite of the season and the disapproval of the right-thinking elements of Lansquenet. But this I attribute to the novelty of such a shop. That will wear off. Our parishioners have little enough money already for their everyday needs without subsidizing a place more suited to the big cities. La Céleste Praline. Even the name is a calculated insult. I shall take the bus to Agen, to the housing rental agency, and complain. She should never have been allowed to take the lease in the first place. The central location of the shop ensures a kind of prosperity, encourages temptation. The bishop should be informed. Perhaps he may be able to exercise the influence I do not possess. I shall write to him today. I see her sometimes in the street. She wears a yellow raincoat with green daisies, a child's garment but for its length, slightly indecent on a grown woman. Her hair remains uncovered, even in the rain, gleaming sleekly as a seal's pelt. She wrings it out like a long rope as she reaches the awning. There are often people waiting under that awning, sheltering from the interminable rain and watching the window display. She has installed an electric fire now, close enough to the counter to provide comfort, though not close enough to damage her wares. And with the stools, the glass cloche filled with cakes and pies, the silver jugs of chocolate on the hob, the place looks more like a cafe than a shop. I often see 10 or more people in there on some days, some standing, some leaning against the padded counter and talking. On Sunday and Wednesday afternoons, the smell of baking fills the damp air, and she leans in the doorway, floury to the elbows, throwing out pert remarks at the passers-by. I am amazed at how many people she now knows by name. It was 6 months before I knew all of my flock. And she always seems ready with a question or a comment about their lives, their problems. Blaireau's arthritis, Lambert's soldier son, Narcisse and his prize orchids. She even knows the name of Duplessis' dog. Oh, she is wily.
Impossible to fail to notice her. One must respond or seem churlish. Even I must smile and nod, though inside I am seething. Her daughter follows her lead, running wild in Les Marais with a gang of older girls and boys. 8 or 9 years old, most of them, and they treat her with affection like a little sister, like a mascot. They're always together, running, shouting, making their arms into bomber planes and shooting each other, chanting, catcalling. Jean Drew is among them, in spite of his mother's concern. Once or twice she has tried to forbid him, but he grows more rebellious every day, climbing out of his bedroom window when she shuts him in. But I have more serious concerns, mon père, than the behaviour of a few unruly brats. Passing by Les Marais before Mass today, I saw, moored at the side of the Tann, a houseboat of the type you and I both know well. A wretched thing, green-painted but peeling miserably, a tin chimney spouting black and noxious fumes, a corrugated roof, like the roofs of the cardboard shacks in Marseille's bidonville. You and I know what this means, what it will bring about. The first of spring's dandelions, poking their heads from out of the sodden turf of the roadside. Every year they try it, mon père, coming up river from the cities and the shanty towns, or worse, further afield from Algeria and Morocco, looking for work, looking for a place to settle, to breed. I preached a sermon against them this morning, but I know that in spite of this, some of my parishioners, Narcisse amongst them, will make them welcome in defiance of me. They are vagrants. They have no respect and no values. They are the river gypsies, spreaders of disease, thieves, liars, murderers when they can get away with it. Let them stay and they will spoil everything we have worked for, Père, all our education. Their children will run with ours until everything we have done for them is ruined. They will steal our children's minds away, teach them hatred and disrespect for the church, teach them laziness and avoidance of responsibility, teach them crime and the pleasures of drugs. Have they already forgotten what happened that summer? Are they fool enough to believe the same thing will not happen again? I went to the houseboat this afternoon. Two more had already joined it, one red and one black. The rain had stopped and there was a line of washing strung between the two new arrivals, upon which children's clothes hung limply. On the deck of the black boat a man sat with his back to me fishing, long red hair tied with scrap of cloth, bare arms tattooed to the shoulder in henna. I stood watching the boats, marvelling at their wretchedness, their defiant poverty. What good are these people doing themselves? We are a prosperous country, a European power. There should be jobs for these people, useful jobs, good housing. Why did they then choose to live like this, in idleness and misery? Are they so lazy? The red-haired man on the deck of the black boat forked a protective sign at me and returned to his fishing. You can't stay here, I called across the water. This is private property. You must move on. Laughter and jeering from the boats. I felt an angry throbbing at my temples, but remained calm. You can talk to me, I called again. I am a priest. We can always find a solution. Several faces had appeared at the windows and doorways of the three boats. I saw four children, a young woman with a baby, and three or four older people, swathed in the grey no-colour which characterises these people, their faces sharp and suspicious. I saw that they turned to red hair for their cue. I addressed him. Hey, you! His posture was all attentiveness and ironic deference. Why don't you come over here and talk? I can explain better if I'm not shouting at you across half the river, I told him. Explain away, he said. He spoke with such a thick Marseille accent I could hardly make out his words. Right near you, fine. His people on the other boats nudged each other and sniggered. I waited patiently for silence. "This is private property," I repeated. "You can't stay here, I'm afraid. There are people living along here." I indicated the riverside houses along the Avenue des Marais. True, many of them are now deserted, having fallen into disrepair from damp and neglect, but some are still inhabited. Red Hare gave me a scornful look. "There are also people living here," he said, indicating the boats. "I understand that, but nevertheless..." He cut me short. "Don't worry, we're not staying long." His tone was final. "We need to make repairs, collect supplies. We can't do that in the middle of the countryside. We'll be 2 weeks, maybe three. Think you can live with that, eh?" "Perhaps a bigger village." I felt myself bristling at his insolent air, but remained calm. "A town like Agen, maybe." Shortly. "That's no good. We came from there." "I'm sure he did. They take a hard line with vagrants in Agen. If only we had our own police in Lansquenay." "I've got a problem with my engine. I've been trailing oil for miles downriver. I gotta fix it before I can move on." I squared my shoulders. "I don't think you'll find what you're looking for here," I said. "Well, everyone has an opinion." He sounded dismissive, almost amused. One of the old women cackled. "Even a priest is entitled to that." More laughter. I kept my dignity. These people are not worth my anger. I turned to leave. "Well, well, it's Monsieur le Curé." The voice came from just behind me, and in spite of myself I recoiled. Armand Voisin gave a small crow of laughter. "Nervous, eh?" she said maliciously. "You should be. You're out of your territory here, aren't you? What's the mission this time? Converting the pagans?" "Madame?" In spite of her insolence, I gave her a polite nod. "I trust you're in good health?" "Oh, do you?" Her black eyes fizzed with laughter. "I was under the impression that you couldn't wait to give me the last rites." "Not at all, madame." I was coldly dignified. "Good. Because this old lamb's never going back into the fold," she declared. "Too tough for you, anyway. I remember your mother saying..." I bit her off more sharply than I intended. "I'm afraid I have no time for chit-chat today, madame. These people..." A gesture in the direction of the river gypsies. "These people must be dealt with before the situation gets out of hand. I have the interests of my flock to protect." "What a windbag you are nowadays," remarked Armand lazily. "The interests of your flock. I remember when you were just a little boy playing Indians in Les Marais. What did they teach you in the city, apart from pompousness and self-importance?" I glared at her. Alone in all Lansquenay, she delights in reminding me of things best forgotten. It occurs to me that when she dies, that memory will die with her, and I am almost glad of it. "You may relish the thought of vagrants taking over Les Marais," I told her sharply, "but other people, your daughter among them, understand that if you allow them to get a foot in the door..." Armand gave a snort of laughter. "She even talks like you," she said. "Strings of pulpit clichés and nationalist platitudes. Seems to me these people are doing no harm. Why make a crusade of expelling them when they'll be leaving soon anyway?" I shrugged. "Clearly you don't want to understand the issue," I said shortly. "Well, I already told Rue over there," a sly wave to the man on the black houseboat. "I told him he and his friends would be welcome for as long as it takes to fix his engine and stock up on food." She gave me a sly, triumphant look. "So you can't say they're trespassing. They're here, in front of my house, with my blessing." She gave the last word special emphasis, as if to taunt me. "As are their friends when they arrive." She shot me another of her insolent glances. "All their friends." Well, I should have expected it. She would have done it only to spite me. She enjoys the notoriety it affords her, knowing that as the village's oldest resident, a certain license is allowed her. There is no point in arguing with her, mon père. We know that already. She would enjoy the argument as much as she relishes contact with these people, their stories, their lives. Not surprising that she has already learned their names. I will not allow her the satisfaction of seeing me plead. No. I must go about the business in other ways. I have learned one thing from Armand, at least. There will be others. How many, we must wait and see. But it is as I feared. 3 of them today. Tomorrow, how many more? I called on Clermont on the way here. He will spread the word. I expect some resistance. Armand still has friends. Narcisse may need some persuasion. But on the whole, I expect cooperation. I am still someone in this village. My good opinion counts for something. I saw Muscat, too. He sees most people in his café, head of the residence committee. A right-thinking man, in spite of his faults. A good churchgoer. And if a strong hand were needed, of course we all deplore violence. But with these people we cannot rule out the possibility. Well, I am certain that Muscat would oblige. Armand called it a crusade. She meant it as an insult, I know, but even so, I feel a surge of excitement at the thought of this conflict. Could this be the task for which God has chosen me? This is why I came to Lansquenet, mon père, to fight for my people, to save them from temptation. And when Vianne Rocher sees the power of the church, my influence over every single soul in the community, then she will know she has lost. Whatever her hopes, her ambitions, she will understand that she cannot stay, cannot fight and hope to win. I will stand triumphant. Monday, February the 24th. Caroline Clermont called just after Mass. Her son was with her, satchel slung across his shoulders, a tall boy with a pale, impassive face. She was carrying a bundle of yellow, hand-lettered cards. I smiled at them both. The shop was almost empty. I expect the first of my regulars at about 9, and it was 8:30. Only Anouk was sitting at the counter, a half-finished bowl of milk and a pain au chocolat in front of her. She shot a bright glance at the boy, waved the pastry in a vague gesture of greeting, and returned to her breakfast. "Can I help you?" Caroline looked around her with an expression of envy and disapproval. The boy stared straight in front of him, but I saw his eyes wanting to slide towards Anouk. He looked polite and sullen, his eyes bright and unreadable beneath an overlong fringe. "Yes." Her voice is light and falsely cheery, her smile as sharp and sweet as icing setting the teeth on edge. "I'm distributing these," she held out the stack of cards, "and I wonder if you'd mind displaying one in your window." She held it out. "Everyone else is putting them up," she added, as if that might sway my decision. I took the card. Black on yellow, in neat bold capitals. "No hawkers, vagrants, or peddlers. The management retains the right to refuse to serve at any given time." "Well, why do I need this?" I frowned, puzzled. "Why should I want to refuse to serve anyone?" Caroline sent me a look of pity and contempt. "Of course you are new here," she said with a sugared smile. "But we have had problems in the past. It's just a precaution, anyway. I very much doubt you'll get a visit from those people. But you may as well be safe as sorry, don't you think?" I still didn't understand. "Sorry about what?" "Well, the gypsies, the river people." There was a note of impatience in her voice. "They're back, and they'll be wanting to..." She made a small, elegant moo of disgust. "Do whatever it is they do." "And?" I prompted gently. "Well, but we'll have to show them we won't stand for it." Caroline was becoming flustered. "We're going to have an agreement not to serve these people. Make them go back to wherever it is they came from.
Oh. I considered what she was saying.
Can we refuse to serve them? I inquired curiously. If they have the money to spend, can we refuse?
Impatiently, of course we can. Who's to stop us?
I thought for a moment, then handed back the yellow card.
Caroline stared at me.
You're not going to do it?
Her voice rose half an octave, losing much of its well-bred intonation in the process.
I shrugged. It seems to me that if someone wants to spend their money here, it isn't up to me to stop them, I told her.
But the community, insisted Caroline. Surely you don't want people of that type? Itinerants, thieves, Arabs, for heaven's sake?
Flutter click snapshot of memory. Scowling New York doormen, Paris ladies, Sacré-Cœur tourists, camera in hand, face averted to avoid seeing the beggar girl with her too short dress and too long legs. Caroline Clermont, for all her rural upbringing, knows the value of finding the right modiste. The discreet scarf she wears at her throat bears an Hermès label, and her perfume is Coco de Chanel. My reply was sharper than I intended. It strikes me that the community should mind its own business, I said tartly. It isn't up to me, or anybody, to decide how these people should live their lives.
Caroline gave me a venomous look.
Oh, well, if that's how you feel, turning superciliously towards the door, then I won't keep you from your business.
A slight emphasis upon the last word, a disdainful glance at the empty seats.
I just hope you don't regret your decision, that's all.
Why should I?
She shrugged petulantly. Well, if there's trouble or anything.
From her tone, I gathered the conversation was at an end.
These people can cause all kinds of trouble, you know. Drugs, violence.
The sourness of her smile suggested that if there were any such trouble, she would be pleased to see me the victim of it. The boy stared at me without comprehension. I smiled back.
I saw your grandmother the other day, I told him. She told me a lot about you.
The boy flushed and mumbled something unintelligible.
Caroline stiffened. I'd heard she was here, she said. She forced a smile. You really shouldn't encourage my mother, she added with counterfeit archness. She's quite bad enough already.
Oh, I found her most entertaining company, I replied without taking my eyes off the boy.
Quite refreshing, and very sharp.
For her age, said Caroline.
For any age, I said. Well, I'm sure she seems so to a stranger, said Caroline tightly. But to her family...
She flashed me another of her cold smiles.
You have to understand that my mother is very old, she explained. Her mind isn't what it used to be. Her grasp of reality...
She broke off with a nervous gesture.
Well, I'm sure I don't have to explain to you, she said.
No, you don't, I answered pleasantly. It's none of my business, after all.
I saw her eyes narrow as she registered the barb. She may be bigoted, but she isn't stupid.
I mean, she floundered for a few moments. For a second, I thought I saw a glint of humour in the boy's eyes, though that might have been my imagination.
I mean my mother doesn't always know what's best for her.
She was back in control again, her smile as lacquered as her hair.
This shop, for instance.
I nodded encouragement.
My mother is diabetic, explained Caroline. The doctor has warned her repeatedly to avoid sugar in her diet. She refuses to listen. She won't accept treatment.
She glanced at her son with a kind of triumph.
Oh, tell me, Madame Rocher, is that normal? Is that a normal way to behave?
Her voice was rising again, becoming shrill and petulant. Her son looked vaguely embarrassed and glanced at his watch.
Maman, I'll be late.
His voice was neutral and polite. To me, excuse me, madame, I have to get to school.
Here, have one of my special pralines. On the house.
I held it out to him in a twist of cellophane.
My son doesn't eat chocolate. Caroline's voice was sharp. He's hyperactive, sickly. He knows it's bad for him.
I looked at the boy. He looked neither sickly nor hyperactive, merely bored and a little self-conscious.
She thinks a great deal about you, I told him, your grandmother. Maybe you could drop in and say hello one of these days. She's one of my regulars.
The bright eyes flickered for a moment from beneath the lank brown hair.
Maybe.
The voice was unenthusiastic.
My son doesn't have time to hang about in sweet shops, said Caroline loftily. My son's a gifted boy. He knows what he owes his parents.
There was a kind of threat in what she said, a smug note of certainty. She turned to walk past Luke, who was already in the doorway, his satchel swinging.
Luke?
My voice was low, persuasive. He turned again with some reluctance. I was reaching for him before I knew it, seeing past the polite, blank face and seeing...
Do you like Rambo?
I spoke without thinking, my head reeling with images. For a moment the boy looked guilty.
What?
Rambo. She gave you a book of his poems for your birthday, didn't she?
Yes.
The reply was almost inaudible. His eyes, they are a bright green-grey, lifted towards mine. I saw him give a tiny shake of his head, as if in warning.
I didn't read them, though, he said in a louder voice. I'm not a fan of poetry.
A dog-eared book, carefully hidden at the bottom of a clothes chest. A boy murmuring the lovely words to himself with a peculiar fierceness. Please come, I whispered silently. Please, for Armand's sake. Something in his eyes flickered.
I have to go now.
Caroline was waiting impatiently at the door.
Please, take these.
I handed him the tiny packet of praline. The boy has secrets. I could feel them itching to escape. Deftly, keeping out of his mother's line of vision, he took the packet, smiled. I might almost have imagined the words he mouthed as he went.
Tell her I'll be there, he whispered.
Tell her Wednesday, when Maman goes to the hairdresser's. Then he was gone. I told Armand about their visit when she came later today. She shook her head and rocked with laughter when I recounted my conversation with Caroline. Ensconced in her sagging armchair, a cup of mocha in her delicate claw, she looked more like an apple doll than ever.
My poor Caro doesn't like to be reminded, does she?
She sipped the drink gleefully.
Where does she get off, eh?
She demanded with some testiness.
Telling you what I can and can't have. Diabetic, am I? That's what her doctor would like us all to think.
She grunted.
Well, I'm still alive, aren't I? I'm careful. But that isn't enough for them. No, they have to have control.
She shook her head.
Oh, that poor boy. He stutters. Did you notice that?
I nodded.
That's his mother's doing.
Armand was scornful.
If she'd left him alone, but no, always correcting him, always carrying on, making him worse. Making out there's something wrong with him all the time.
She made a sound of derision.
There's nothing wrong with him that a good dose of living wouldn't cure, she declared stoutly. Let him run a while without worrying what would happen if he fell over. Let him loose. Let him breathe.
I said that it was normal for a mother to be protective of her children. Armand gave me one of her satirical glances.
Is that what you call it? She said. The same way the mistletoe is protective of the apple tree?
She gave a cackle.
I used to have apple trees in my garden, she told me. Mistletoe got them all one by one. Nasty little plant. Doesn't look like much. Pretty berries. No strength of its own, but, Lord, invasive.
She sipped again at her drink.
And poison to everything it touches.
She nodded to me knowingly.
That's my Caro, she said. That's her.
I saw Guillaume again after lunch. He didn't stop except to say hello, saying he was on his way to the newsagent for his papers. Guillaume is addicted to film magazines, although he never goes to the cinema, and every week he receives an entire parcel of them, Video and Cine Club, Telerama and Film Express. His is the only satellite dish in the village, and in his sparse little house there is a widescreen television and a Toshiba video recorder wall-mounted above an entire bookcase of video cassettes. I noticed that he was carrying Charlie again, the dog looking dull-eyed and listless on his master's arm. Every few moments Guillaume stroked the dog's head with the familiar gesture of tenderness and finality. "How is he?" I asked at last. "Oh, he has his good days," said Guillaume. "There's plenty of life in him yet." And they went on their way, the small, dapper man clutching his sad brown dog, as if his life depended upon it.